texting me. She wants to fly out from India and take us shopping. That's not a distraction. That's a reason to throw myself into the ocean. I need an explosion or something. You're a 16-year-old boy, she said. I think we'll probably need a serial killer. Leander Holmes would turn up the next day. 3 days later, he would disappear. And for weeks and weeks after, I'd wonder if, by wishing, we'd brought everything that happened after that onto ourselves. 3. I woke to Charlotte beside me and someone else flinging back the curtains. Even with the sudden brightness, even knowing there was a stranger in my room, I couldn't make myself look. It felt like I'd gotten less than 5 minutes of sleep, maybe 5 minutes in the last 5 months, and my body was finally drawing the line. "Go away," I mumbled and rolled over. The lamp flicked on. "Charlotte," a low, lazy voice said, "when I gave you that T-shirt, I didn't intend for you to interpret it literally." At that, I cracked an eye open, but the man speaking was too backlit to see. "I don't think you intended for me to ever wear it, either," Holmes was saying beside me, but she sounded pleased. Somehow she didn't look tired at all. On the contrary, she was sitting up, her knees tucked under her shirt, stretching out the words, "Chemistry is for lovers." "It really is the worst Christmas present I've ever gotten, and that's saying something."
"Worse than the time that Milo bought you a Barbie," the figure tutted. "I really must be a monster. Come on, Goose, introduce me to your boyfriend, unless you want to continue pretending he's invisible, in which case I'll play along."
Holmes paused. "No lecture." Leander, because it had to be Leander, laughed.
"You've done worse things, and anyway, it's fairly clear you aren't actually having sex. This may be indelicate, but those sheets aren't hardly wrinkled enough. So I'm not quite sure what I should be lecturing you on."
That was it. I was going to pass a law against people making deductions before lunch. As I sat up, rubbing at my eyes, Leander crossed to the other side of the bed. I finally got a good look at him. We'd met once before, at my 7th birthday party. He'd brought me a pet rabbit. All I remembered was a tall man with broad shoulders who'd spent most of the party laughing with my father in a corner. That impression held true, though the man standing in front of me was impeccably well-dressed, given the hour. The clock beside me read 7:15, because the world was trying to kill me. He was wearing a blazer, and his shoes were shined up like mirrors. Below his slicked-back hair, his eyes were wrinkled with smile lines. He held out a hand to shake.
"Jamie Watson," he said. "Do you know, you look just like your father did when I met him, which is making all of this quite a bit stranger for me, so could you please get out of the bed you're sharing with my niece?"
I scrambled to my feet.
"We're not... I'm not... It's very nice to meet you."
Behind me, Holmes was snickering, and I rounded on her.
"Come on, really? Some backup would be nice.
Do you want me to give him the details, then?"
"Do you want me to give you a shovel so you can keep on digging me this hole?"
"Please,"
she shot back.
"I'd rather watch. You're doing such a nice job of it, after all."
Something was wrong. Our usual banter sounded meaner, pettier than usual. I stopped, not sure what to say. Leander saved me.
"Children," he said, pulling the door open. "Stop bickering, or I won't make you breakfast."
The kitchen was cavernous, all metal and marble and glass. The housekeeper was already hard at work, rolling out a blanket of dough on the counter. I don't know why it surprised me. Clearly Holmes's parents weren't making their own meals, if last night's formal dinner was any indication.
"Hello, Sarah," Leander said, pressing a kiss to her cheek. "How late were you up last night, cleaning up after that soiree? I'll take over. We'll send breakfast to your room."
He gave her a look I recognized too well, a criminally charming smile straight out of the "Charlotte Holmes is conning you" playbook. The housekeeper laughed and blushed and finally gave up her apron to his waiting hands before she left. At the counter, Holmes propped her head on her fists.
"You're much more efficient at that than I am."
Leander didn't answer for a moment, selecting a saucepan from the hanging copper rack.
Holmes's eyes followed his hands. "You do know that it works best if you mean what you're saying," he said. "Fried eggs?"
"I'm not hungry," she leaned forward. "You have some fascinating bruises on your wrists."
"I do," he said, as if she'd commented on the weather. "Jamie, bacon, biscuits?"
"God, yes. Is there a kettle here somewhere? I need tea."
He pointed with his spatula, and the two of us got down to making a breakfast fit for an army. The whole time, Holmes sat with narrowed eyes, taking him apart.
"Go on, then," Leander said finally. "Let's hear if the deductions you're making are correct."
Holmes didn't waste any time.
"Your shoes are hastily laced, the right's done up in a different pattern than the left, and your blazer wrinkled at the elbows. And I know you're aware of that. You're as aware as I am of these things. Which means that either you're trying to send a message to someone, or you actually are too worn out and tired to care that you're pressed to something less than perfection. Which means that things have been very hard for you lately. Your hair was just cut by someone in Germany. Don't give me that look. It's far more avant-garde than your usual, and Milo mentioned seeing you recently. Berlin, then. If you were to take the pomade out, it'd fall just like one of Jamie's emo singers. Oh, stop glaring, both of you. I happen to know that Uncle Leander has been going to the same barber in Eastbourne since his teens." Impatiently, she pulled at her own hair. "You're hiding a limp. You've developed some terrific neck beard, and... have you been kissing someone?"
The kettle began to whistle loudly enough that neither of them heard me laugh. Leander made a tisking motion with his spatula.
"Charlotte," he was the only one in her family, I noticed, not to call her by her nickname. "Darling girl, I won't tell you a single thing unless you agree to eat."
"Fine," a smile crept across her face. "Hateful man."
After Leander brought a tray up to the housekeeper's room, we settled in around the counter, and I snuck another look at Holmes's uncle. She was right. He did look tired. The kind of tired I remembered from late last fall, where I felt like I wasn't allowed the vulnerability of sleep. That, coupled with the trace of worry behind his showman's smile, and I wondered just where he'd been before Sussex.
"Germany," he said, picking the thought out of my head. "Charlotte was right on that count. The government asked me to uncover a forgery ring that may or may not be churning out work by a German painter from the 30s. I've been in rather deep cover, and for a long time. It's a delicate business. You're winning the trust of some dangerous people, and you need to know how to talk to skittish art students ripping off Rembrandts to make a living." Unexpectedly, he grinned.
"It's quite fun, honestly. Like playing whack-a-mole, only with guns and a wig." Holmes tugged at the cuff of his shirt, exposing the bruise beneath.
"Yes, fun."
"Eat your bacon or I won't explain."
He pushed her plate toward her.
"Like I said, I've not been involved with the most genteel crowd these past few months. And honestly, I didn't really want to take this case to begin with. As interesting as it is, it involves so much legwork, and my legs are happiest on my ottoman. I like a pretty little puzzle as much as the next man, but this... well, and then I had lunch with your father, Jamie, and he persuaded me to take it. Like old times, he said, when we were sleuthing together in Edinburgh. He has a family now, so he's less mobile than I am, but I've been sending him daily emails, and he's helping me put it together from afar."
"Really?" I asked, bemused.
"He's helpful?"
My father was excitable, irresponsible, a little touched in the head. I had some trouble imagining him as an analytical genius. Leander raised an eyebrow. "Do you really think I would involve him if he wasn't?" I raised my eyebrow right back. My father might be helpful, sure, or he might just be the audience for Leander's magic show. With Holmes's, you never really knew where you stood. Next to me, mine was ripping up her biscuit.
"Yes, but the bruises and the kissing..."
"Deep cover," her uncle said in a dramatic voice. "Deep, deep cover." She wrinkled her nose.
"Then why are you here in England? Not that I'm not happy to see you."
Leander stood and gathered our plates.
"Because your father has contacts I can't gain access to through my illegitimate means. Because I wanted to get a good look at Jamie here, since the two of you are now attached at the hip, morning and night, apparently."
Holmes shrugged, her shoulders thin under her shirt, and she brought a sliver of biscuit to her mouth. I watched her, the line of her arm, how her lips still looked bee-stung from the night before. Or was I imagining that detail, coloring it in because I needed to make it a story, to see cause and effect where there wasn't any? She'd almost kissed me. I'd wanted her to. Everything was fine.
"If it matters at all," Leander said from the sink, rolling up his sleeves. "I approve."
Holmes smiled at him, and I smiled at him because neither of us knew what to say. It was like the night before existed in some other universe, a lone hour in a sea of awkwardness where we could talk to each other the way we used to, and now that it was over, we were adrift again. The next few days passed slowly, as most punishments do. During the day, I read the Faulkner novel I'd brought in a sunny alcove off the servants' quarters. Those rooms stood mostly empty now, so I didn't have to worry about being found. Which was a relief. I'd run out of things to say to Holmes's parents fairly quickly. Even if I found her mother terrifying, I didn't hate her. She was ill and worried about her daughter. Then Alistair told us that Emma's condition had begun to deteriorate. She stopped eating meals with us. One night before dinner, I found Leander giving directions to nursing staff as they hauled a hospital bed in through the front door. "I thought she had fibromyalgia," Holmes murmured over my shoulder. "Fibromyalgia doesn't require a live-in team. I thought she was getting better." I managed not to jump. She'd taken to doing that, to ghosting at the edges of whatever room I was in, and then, as soon as I noticed her, giving an excuse and running away. So I didn't say anything, didn't try to comfort her, just watched Leander grimace as the orderly crashed the bed into the door frame. Upstairs, a man's raised voice said, "But the offshore accounts! No, I refuse!" Was it Alistair's? A door slammed. It didn't matter. By the time I turned to her, Holmes was already gone. I found Leander later in the living room. Living room might have been too friendly a name for what it was. A black sofa. A low, expensive-looking table. A cowhide rug beneath them. I'd been prowling the halls, looking for my absent best friend, and found her uncle and mother instead. I was surprised. A hospital bed had just come through the front door, and I'd expected that she'd be in it. But no, she was on her back on the sofa, the heels of her hands pressed against her forehead, while Leander loomed over her.
"This is the last favor I'll do for you," he was saying in a low, furious voice. "For the rest of our lives, this is the last one. I want you to understand that. No school tuition, no bailouts. You could have asked me for anything, but this..." She dragged her hands down her face.
"I know what the word last means, Leander," she said. And in that moment, she sounded exactly like her daughter.
"So when?" he asked. "When will you need me?"
"You'll know," Emma said. "We're almost there." At that she stood, swaying on her feet, like all the soft parts of her had shriveled away, leaving a dusty, exhausted shell. Leander noticed it too, reaching out a hand to steady her, but she held up a hand in warning. With slow, labored steps, she left the room.
"Hello, Jamie," Leander said, his back still to me.
"How did you know it was me?" I said lightly. "You all need a different party trick. I almost expect that one now."
"Sit," he said, and motioned me over to the sofa. "Where's Charlotte?"
I shrugged. "I thought it might be like that," he said. "Is everything okay with Mrs. Holmes?" I asked in an attempt to change the subject.
"No," he said. "That's obvious, though. Tell me, I've been in touch with your father, of course, but I'd like to hear it from you. How's your family doing? How's your darling little sister? Is she still into your little sparkle ponies, or whatever they're called? James misses her something awful."
"Shelby's good," I said. "She's past the sparkle ponies and onto painting portraits of dogs, starting to look at secondary schools near our flat."
Leander smiled at me. "James was making noises about having us sent to Sherringford. Might be nice to have you both in the same place. Do Sunday dinners, go mini-golfing on the weekend, or to the roller rink. Roller rinking is a family activity, right?"
Right. Though I was pretty sure it was called roller skating and that I'd rather die before doing it. I heard you say no school tuition, though. We can't afford to send Shelby to Sherringford. Not on our own, and it's no secret anymore that you're footing my bill. His smile faded.
That doesn't apply to your family. It never would. I'd stand by your father through anything, Jamie, because I know he'd never ask me to.
It doesn't matter. Listen, don't ever think you'll be a casualty in this war.
You won't be. I'll make sure of it.
An invisible war with invisible blood. Or not invisible, just not our own, not yet. Lee Dobson had been a casualty already, and I'd come knife's edge close to becoming one myself.
How did this even start? I asked him.
It was a question that had been nagging me for weeks.
Like, why did the Holmeses hire August Moriarty anyway?
I know it was a publicity stunt or whatever, but if you all hated each other so much, why would Holmes's parents take that risk?
It's not a short story, you know.
I laughed. I mean, I don't know how I'll fit it into my busy schedule of being avoided. And it was true. What else was I going to do this afternoon? I might as well fill in some of the blanks that Holmes wouldn't help me with.
Fine, he said. But if you're going to make me tell it, we're going to need some tea.
10 minutes and one pot of Earl Grey later, we were settled back onto the sofa. Somewhere in the distance, I heard the rush of the sea.
You're familiar with Sherlock Holmes's run-ins with Professor Moriarty, aren't you?
Sherlock took down a number of notorious men, but Moriarty was the one at the top.
A right bastard.
Every other criminal in England paid him protection money. He orchestrated their actions, knit them together into a web, and Holmes was able to deduce the spider from that web. Absently, he rubbed at his temple.
Stop me if you've heard this before.
I've heard it before, I said, blowing on my tea. Half the world had heard it before. Sherlock Holmes squaring off against the professor. Holmes and Dr. Watson's flight to Switzerland to escape him. My great-great-great-grandfather on a hill overlooking a waterfall, wondering if his best friend and partner had died in its depths. Both Holmes and Moriarty had disappeared that day. Moriarty, for good, and the man who'd come back to Baker Street had done so only years later, after eradicating the last of the crime lord's agents. Or so the story went.
When I was a child, I never understood the fixation on Moriarty, Leander was saying. He's never mentioned in the Good Doctor's stories, not until The Final Problem, where it's like he was invented to explain all these fabulously strange crimes that Sherlock had investigated. Then he's gone again. And, you know, growing up, our relationship with that family was fairly civil. A bit apologetic, really. They didn't have the best reputation. Being cursed with an infamous last name will do that to you. But sins of the father and so on. They weren't the Napoleons of crime. I said as much to my father.
How did that go?
Leander ran a hand over his slicked back hair.
Poorly, he admitted.
He told me that there's a criminal strain in their blood. We might have been at peace when this August business started, but we'd spent the majority of the 20th century tangling with them, one way or another.
We did?
I said, then corrected myself.
You did?
From what I understood, the Watsons mostly spent the 20th century losing their spectacular fortune at cards.
Forgive me if I get the dates wrong, Leander said, sipping his tea.
But 1918, Fiona Moriarty, dressed as a man, secures a position as a guard at Sing Sing. The costume, as I understand it, involved flower bags tied around her waist for bulk. Apparently it was splendid. After spending 2 months beating up the most hardened criminals in the world, and, one assumes, gathering data, she quits her job. 2 weeks later, she gets herself arrested for robbing a bank in broad daylight, disguised as a different man, and is thrown behind bars. Within the night, she has escorted 20 prisoners out of Sing Sing through a tunnel she'd spent the last 10 days digging. A tunnel that went under the Hudson River. I let out a low whistle.
Did she get away with it?
He grinned.
Tunnels have 2 openings, don't they? My great-grandfather had built a bonfire at the exit. Those poor prisoners all ran, yelling, back to their cells. Thought they'd found their freedom.
found lots of smoke instead. And she was put behind bars herself. Her scheme had been clever, you know. A good 5 of those prisoners were her father's lieutenants, men who had helped raise her, who, after her father's death, escaped to America looking to avoid the long arm of Sherlock Holmes. Leander raised an eyebrow.
Sentiment. It always gets you in the end.
He had on his quoting voice for that part.
You can't believe that, I said.
She certainly did, by the end of it. The funny thing is that Fiona was loaded. She had enough money to bribe the local judges, to bribe the police force, to bribe the Tammany Hall mobsters. And she tried, but none of them would touch her money. Too afraid of the consequences on our end. Ultimately, one of them wrote his old friend, Henry Holmes, who got on the next ship for America, just in time to uncover his scheme and put a stop to it. And that wasn't the end of it, I guess. No, it goes on like that. 1930, bank vault heist, Glasgow. All the culprits caught, but the jewels missing. Guess who shows up in society wearing £1 million worth of rubies? He laughed at my expression. Jamie, you've been in America too long. Pounds sterling, the currency. Apparently one of their hired cons had delivered the rubies to them through the sewer using a pulley system. Quentin Moriarty claimed his wife's jewels came from an inheritance, but Jonathan Holmes disproved that through a pair of rats, a scalpel, and a lady's handkerchief. 1944, and the Moriartys are raiding the museums of Europe during the Second World War. 1968, and they're chairing the Nobel Prize Committee. 1972, and my older sister Araminta was asked to decode a series of messages that used Francis Bacon's substitution cipher. They were being used to negotiate the sale of nuclear warheads. To Walter Moriarty. What on earth would a Moriarty do with a warhead? Sell it again, probably, and at a profit. He went to trial. 2 jurors developed rare forms of cancer. The judge's wife went missing. All quiet, all out of the news. And then someone killed all 3 of Araminta's cats.
Jesus, I said. That's awful.
Walter Moriarty was out of jail 16 weeks later. A travesty. And still, you must remember this. The family wasn't all bad. He refilled his cup. Really, there was only 1 bad apple in a generation. The rest, well, I knew of Patrick Moriarty when I was younger. We ran into each other at a party at Oxford, got drunk enough to duck into a corner and compare notes. We got to talking about the bad blood between our families, though it was nothing like it is now, and he said that the fundamental difference between us was that Holmeses were heartless optimists, and they were hedonist pessimists.
Heartless optimists?
My Holmes didn't seem particularly optimistic.
Meaning?
Do you know that old image of Lady Justice? All done up with the blindfold and the scales. Made of shiny copper, not to be touched. I thought of us that way. In order to pass judgment on other men, you remove yourself from them. Not all Holmeses are detectives, you know. Far from it. Mostly we end up in government. Some scientists, some lawyers. One really dry stick of a cousin sells insurance. But when we do detective work, we tend to work outside the law. We have our own resources. And at times, when the law won't prosecute, we are our own jury. To wield that kind of power, it makes sense that you wouldn't let yourself be blinded by your emotions. Would it really help you to put a man away to know he'd leave behind a starving child? And, to top it all off, it's not in our natures to be effusive. We're mostly brains, you know. The body's just something to get us from place to place. But over time, we calcified. Went brittle, staring at ourselves for so long. Maybe it made us better at our jobs, because you don't do this kind of work unless you think it'll really make a difference, really make the world better. And you don't think you can make the world better unless you are a tremendous egomaniac.
And the Moriartys?
Leander considered me over his teacup. They have gobs of money and a family name that made them pariahs, and quite a few of them grow up to be geniuses. So they feel entitled to the best parts of the world. Extrapolate from there, my dear Watson. But it wasn't really until this current crop that there were so many marvellously depraved specimens all at once. I miss the ones like Patrick, he said with a laugh. He grew up to be a hedge fund manager. But we're talking minor evil. ran a couple Ponzi schemes. This lot, well, August was a nice kid, much nicer than Patrick could ever be. August was patient with Charlotte, smart as a whip. When Emma and Alistair hired him, it was because Alistair was about 2 seconds from being the eye of a media hurricane, and we needed to build up some public goodwill. We hadn't had a run-in with the Moriartys in 20 years. Memories fade. It seemed like a good idea at the time. "That'll be written on a few tombstones before this is over," I said. "You have quite the mordant sense of humor." His eyes went far away. "Still, I wonder if you're right. The cycle's beginning all over again." "And my family?" I asked him. "We didn't play a role in any of this?" I sounded like a child. I knew I did, but I'd been raised on the Sherlock Holmes stories. My father styled himself an ex-detective. I'd imagined that we'd been in the thick of it all this time, right beside the Holmeses, fighting the good fight. "Not in a long while," Leander said. "Too many of us were automatons, maybe. Too distant. Our families were friendly, to be sure, but not friends. Not in pairs. Not until I met your father. Until you met Charlotte." I sighed. I couldn't help it. He leaned forward to clap me on the shoulder. "You're a good influence on her. Just give her a bit of space. I don't think she's ever had a friend before you." So I gave her some space. My Faulkner novel in the mornings and silence in the afternoons as I wandered through their library, pulling down the books I wanted to read and wouldn't because they were all first editions, gilt leaf and delicate pages, things meant to be looked at and never opened. I was afraid I'd ruin them. I was afraid for so many pathetic reasons, the scared that in a few weeks I'd be back at school and without Holmes's friendship, that the dread that prickled the back of my neck was the sensation of loss before it came. I was so messed up that I couldn't shake the feeling, even at our dinners, sitting next to Leander, who had taken Emma Holmes's place beside me. In an attempt to cheer me up, he told me ribald, ridiculous stories about my father that always seemed to end with one of them bailing the other out of jail. "I never really bothered to get a license, you see, and the police don't love working with amateurs," he grinned to himself. "The clients did, though, rather avidly. Remind me to tell you the one about your father and the red-headed lady lion tamer." "Please," I said, "please, please don't." Where was Holmes? There and not there, silent as a crow on a power line. Her father was speaking in German to that night's dinner guest, a sculptor from Frankfurt who didn't speak English. There was a whole roster of them, these dinner guests, one or two every night, and as soon as the meal was over, Leander and Alistair would slip away with them to the study and shut the door. It was interminable, waiting for them to stand up and leave so that we could too. Then that day's spell was broken, and Holmes and I would go back to my room, and suddenly we would be able to talk again. The first night, she stood, straightened her skirt, and cast a long look at me before she swept out of the room and down the hall. I followed her as though I were in a dream, losing her around a corner in the house's long and winding corridors. But I knew where she'd be. There, in the guest room at the end of my bed, she was easing the heels off her feet. She dangled one from a finger as she looked up at me, biting her lip, and it should have been ridiculous, but instead it made something in my chest burn. "Hi," I said, dry-mouthed. "Hi," she said, and picked up an encyclopedia that had been invisible on the dark floor. "What do you know of the Bhagavad Gita?"
"Nothing."
I knew nothing about a 700-verse Sanskrit epic, or why I was supposed to care at midnight on a Tuesday in her parents' house, when, the night before, she'd slipped into my bed like an apparition and pulled me down on top of her. She stayed up telling me its history until I fell asleep in a harmless ball. The next night, she told me about 1001 Arabian Nights. No Holmes in the morning. More darkness when I opened the curtains. More Faulkner in the window seat while Holmes's cat, Mouse, glared up at me from my feet. I wondered if she was watching me out of its eyes. I wondered if I was in a feedback loop, an experiment, a never-ending bad dream. When I wandered down the halls, I could hear her playing her violin, and yet she wasn't in her cluttered basement. She wasn't in the parlor. She was nowhere. The arpeggios she played came up as if from the house's foundation. I wandered the house like some Victorian ghost. When I passed the hall hung with paintings, the one that led to Alistair's study, I could clearly hear him say, "He won't call here again." Could hear Leander reply, "You won't have to leave this place. I won't let it happen." Money, always, was the subtext here. Money at stake in the family home. And though I only heard bits and pieces, I couldn't put it all together. I was surrounded by wealth, by power. Why all the whispered arguments? Is this how you kept your prizes once you'd won them? I found myself looking up train schedules. When could I go back to London? Christmas was only a week away, and Shelby was getting an easel from our mother. I wanted to watch her open it. I could go to London, I thought. I could call Lena and see if she was with Tom, my Sherringford roommate and her boyfriend. It would be a relief to see them. We'd play poker, get roaring drunk. He might be my only friend anymore, I found myself thinking. The boy who spied on me for money all this fall. And then I knew I needed to break something right that second. That was how I ended up down by the Holmes's man-made lake. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was pitch dark, and I didn't trust myself to find the ocean. Did it even exist, or was it just a sound, something unreal in the distance, threatening with its weight? It didn't matter. I didn't need it. All I needed were the giant rocks half buried by this pond, my fingernails to pull them up from the mud, my arms to hurl them away from me into the black water. When Leander found me, I'd taken a hatchet from the tool shed and started looking for something else to do.
"Jamie," he said. He was smart to say it from a distance. "Leander," I said. "Not now." There was enough deadfall under the trees to do the job. I started kicking it into a pile, looking for the biggest, thickest branches, the ones that would put up a fight.
"What are you doing?"
I stole a glance at him. He'd stuffed his hands in his pockets, and his roguish smile was nowhere to be seen. "I'm expressing my anger in a healthy way," I said to him, the air quotes visible. "So leave me the hell alone." He didn't. He took a step closer.
"I can get you a sawbuck from the shed."
"No."
"Or a coat?"
"Fuck off." Another step.
"I could get you a bigger axe."
At that, I stopped. "Yeah, okay." We worked in silence, cutting the brush off the thicker branches, weeding out the pieces with knots. There wasn't a stand anywhere near the house, so I braced my first piece on the ground, piling up rocks to keep it upright. Then I lifted the axe above my head and brought it down hard. I couldn't see my hands in front of my face, couldn't hear anything but the blood in my head. Leander set the next piece up, and I split that too, and the next, feeling the hot pull in my shoulders build until it broke down into incredible, brain-numbing exhaustion. I stopped to catch my breath. I had bleeding blisters on both hands. I felt, for the first time in days, like myself, and I let that feeling wash over me for a minute before it too disappeared.
"Well," Leander said, brushing off his clothes, "it's too bad they only have gas fireplaces in that house, or you'd be quite the hero."
I sat down on the woodpile.
"I don't need to be a hero."
"I know," he said. "Sometimes, though, it's easier to be one than to be a person."
Together we looked up to the looming house on the hill.
"I thought Sherlock Holmes kept bees," I said.
I could open all the apiary doors. I could funnel them into that massive, awful dining room and let them build honeycombs down the walls. "I don't see any bees."
"His cottage is my sister Araminta's now. It's down the lane," he said. "I don't go all that often. She doesn't much like visitors."
I lifted an arm experimentally, then stretched it.
"I guess you got all the friendly genes in the family."
"Alistair has his small share, along with a family home."
There was a trace of bitterness in his voice.
"But yes, you're right. I have friends. I throw parties.
I shockingly leave my house on occasion, and, if my deductions are correct, I'm the only Holmes in recent memory to fall in love. I opened my mouth to ask about Charlotte Holmes's parents, then thought better of it. If the two of them were in love, it seemed like it was beside the point. "Are you still with him?" I paused. "It was a him, right?" Leander sighed and sat down next to me. The woodpile shifted under our combined weight.
"What is it that you want from Charlotte?"
He held up a finger.
"Don't give me boyfriend or best friend or any of those other vagaries. Those terms are too loosely defined. Be specific."
I wasn't going to say either of those things. I was about to tell him to stay out of our business. But it wasn't our business anymore. "She makes me better. I make her better. But right now, we're making each other worse. I want to go back to how it was before."
It sounded simple when I said it like that. "Can I give you some advice?" Leander asked, and his voice was like the night around us, cloaked and sad. "A girl like her wasn't ever a girl, and still, she is one. And you? You're going to get yourself hurt either way."
"Speaking of vagaries, what do you mean?"
"Jamie," he said, "the only way out is through." I was too exhausted to talk it through further, so I changed the subject.
"Have you been learning anything? From your contacts, I mean? Anything useful to take back to Germany?"
His eyes narrowed. "Of a sort. I learned that I need to have a word with Hadrian Moriarty. But then, I imagine I'm not alone in that."
Hadrian Moriarty was an art collector, a high-class swindler, and, as I'd learned this fall, a frequent and valued guest on European morning talk shows. I wasn't surprised to hear he was involved in an art scandal.
"And everything's okay. I heard someone yelling about leaving."
I looked down.
"I know it's not my business."
"It's not," Leander said, but he patted me on the shoulder.
"After all that hard work, you'll sleep well tonight. Though I suggest you do it alone and that you lock your door, and then put a chair against it."
"Wait," I paused. "You and that guy, are you two still together? You never said."
"No."
He touched my shoulder briefly and stood to go.
"We never were.
He didn't... He's married now. Or was. And is again." I was beginning to put together a puzzle of my own. Because history ran in circles, and my own life especially so, if Leander had been in love with my father. I thought of that list he'd made, number 74. "Whatever happens between you and Holmes, remember it is not your fault, and likely could not have been prevented, no matter your efforts." I watched Leander Holmes walk up the hill to the house, and then I buried my head in my hands. I locked my door. I put a chair against it. I went to bed alone and woke up to find Charlotte Holmes curled up in a small, dark ball on my floor.
"Watson,"
she said sleepily, lifting her head from the carpet.
"You kept getting texts, so I tossed your phone out the window."
The window in question was still open. A cold wind was driving through it. To my credit... To my everlasting credit, I didn't wrap her in blankets, or scream, or demand answers, or douse the room in gasoline. At least we were on the ground floor. As coolly as I could, I got up, stepped over her, and pulled my phone from a rose bush. 8 texts, I said. "From my father. About Leander."
"Oh."
Holmes sat up, rubbing her arms.
"Can you close that? It's freezing."
I shut the window with a snap.
"Apparently your uncle wasn't in touch yesterday, which wouldn't be a big deal, except my father's gotten an email from him every night for the last 4 months. He wants us to check in, make sure he's okay."
I tried unsuccessfully to keep myself from remembering Leander's forlorn voice. My father... My father, who was perpetually rumpled, pleased with himself.
My father, who bumbled through two countries, a dead-end job, a number of awful mystery stories he wrote out longhand and then read to me dramatically on the phone, doing all the voices. How anyone could love him that way was the real mystery. Holmes's gaze flicked over me, assessing.
You saw him last?
I did?
Leander, he wasn't at dinner. Neither were you.
I'd taken two pieces of bread from the kitchen and gone to my room, unable to face a room full of scrutinizing eyes. I guess I wasn't.
No, the two of you were...
She peered at my hands.
Chopping wood? Really, Watson?
It was an outlet, I said. She was shivering, so I pulled the duvet from the bed to put around her shoulders.
Oh, I'm sorry, she snapped, tossing it off. I forgot that if we don't talk about your feelings every few hours, you devolve into a hipster lumberjack. Never mind how I'm feeling. Yes, in fact, never mind how you're feeling, because it's so easy to talk to you while you're hiding from me all day, playing your violin in invisible closets, barricading your door and pretending you're not there. I'm a marvel of sensitivity compared to you. You're the one who picks a lock and kicks out a chair to sleep on my floor. I did not, she said. I climbed in through that window.
The chair was, in fact, still under the doorknob.
Why? Can you even tell me why you came in here last night? I wanted to see you. I didn't want to talk to you, so I waited until you were sleeping.
She said it like I was a moron.
How is that hard to understand?
Come on, weirdo, I said, but my voice came out strained. Despite her blithe words, her eyes were full of something that looked too much like pain, and I hated that I had caused it. I was causing it now, just standing here. Let's go find your uncle. He's probably sweet-talking the gardener or teaching the neighborhood squirrels to sing. He wasn't in the garden. He wasn't in the kitchen or the parlor. Or the room with the pool table that everyone horribly referred to as the billiards room. The marble floors were cold under my feet, and so I walked quickly after Holmes, who had wrapped herself in a long, trailing robe the color of dust. He might have gone to run errands in Eastbourne, I said as we approached the front hall. With a sigh, she gestured to the window overlooking the grounds.
Of course he hasn't. It rained last night, and there aren't any fresh tire tracks in the drive. We might as well ask my father. There's more than one way to leave the house, and Leander might have been in a hurry. We don't know everything he's found out while he's been here.
She took off again, this time up the stairs to her father's study.
Everything? You've been listening in?
I asked, hurrying to catch up.
Of course I've been listening. What else is there to do in this miserable house?
You weren't avoiding me? You were eavesdropping? She thought about that one.
I might have been doing both. Whatever, keep going. From what I can tell, Leander's been gathering information to bolster the persona he's adopted in Germany. Which cartels have which connections, which low-rent artists are known to forge on the side, who has connections to other cities and which ones. He's tracking two forgers in particular, a Gretchen and someone named Nathaniel.
She frowned.
Though maybe that's his current boyfriend. Or both? That would be fascinating. Holmes.
Leander? Disappearing?
Right. Well, I kept hearing that name through the vent, but not with enough context to figure out exactly who he was to my uncle.
The vent? Holmes swept around a corner.
The vent that leads from my closet up to my father's study.
It made me remember her eerie, omnipresent violin, the way the sound had come from nowhere. It must have been snaking up through the air ducts as Holmes played in her closet. I imagined her in a nest of clothes on the floor, her head tipped back against the wall, playing a sonata with her eyes shut.
Still, none of this tells us anything we need to know at the moment. Ergo, my father.
Holmes, I said. I did not want to deal with her parents if I didn't have to.
Wait, did he leave you a note? Have you checked your phone?
He could already have explained it all. Frowning, she dug her phone out of the pocket of her robe.
I have a new message, she said. 5 minutes ago,
an unknown number.
We stopped in the hallway, and she played it on speaker.
Lottie, I'm fine, Leander said, all bluff cheerfulness. I'll see you soon.
She stared down at it, unbelieving. She played it again.
Lottie, it said. I'm fine. I'll see you soon.
That isn't from his number, I said, peering at her screen. Whose number is that?
Holmes immediately hit the call back button.
The number you have dialed is disconnected.
She tried again.
Again.
Then she flicked back to the message.
Lottie,
And before he could say the rest of it, she put the phone away. I could hear the tinny voice playing out of her pocket.
That isn't what he calls me, she said. He never... I need to see my father.
In the hall that led to the study, the long line of paintings glowered down at us. I was just about to ask Holmes if she'd overheard anything else when the door at the end of the hall opened.
Lottie, Alistair said, blocking the doorway. What are you doing up here?
Have you seen Uncle Leander? She asked him, twisting her hands. He was supposed to take Jamie and me to town for the day.
I wondered how exactly one lied to a Holmes. I'd never successfully done it myself. Could you actually pull it off if you were one too? From the withering look Alistair gave his daughter, I decided you couldn't.
He left last night. One of his contacts in Germany was growing suspicious of his continued absence.
He waved an errant hand.
Of course, he said he loves you, wishes you well, etc.
There was a rustle, and Holmes's father flung an arm across the door.
Mum,
Holmes asked, trying to step around him.
Is she in there? I thought she'd be in her room.
Don't, he said. She's having a very bad day.
But I...
And she ducked under his outstretched arm and into his study. The hospital bed was nowhere to be found. I hadn't seen Emma Holmes in days and had assumed she'd been in her room, but here she was, flung out on the sofa like she'd fallen there. Her ash-blonde hair hung limply around her face, and she was wearing a robe not unlike her daughter's, thrown over a set of pajamas that looked wrinkled and sour. As I opened my mouth, she held up a hand. I glanced over at Holmes, who stiffened. This house was nothing like my family's flat, where you tripped over each other on your way to the bathroom. Here you could go weeks and see only pale marble floors, floating staircases, invisible plastic chairs. You could start to believe you were the only person in the world.
What are your plans for Christmas?
Her mother asked abruptly. Her voice came out in a harsh whisper.
I'm speaking to my daughter.
But she was looking at Alistair and with anger. It must have been terrible to be this way, prone and weak when you were used to commanding the room. Alistair cleared his throat.
Lottie, your brother has just expressed an interest in you staying in Berlin for the holiday.
Oh,
Holmes said, stuffing her hands in her pockets. I could hear the machinery in her brain grinding to life.
Has he?
Don't exhaust your mother, he said. We can have a rational conversation about this.
She has to go.
Emma struggled up to her elbows like a scuttling crab. Her breathing was labored.
She doesn't, Alistair murmured.
He made no motion to help her.
I'd rather have Lottie here. We never see her.
Holmes looked horrified, but her voice was calm.
Milo hasn't spoken to you in weeks, she said. You haven't had that twitch you get on the side of your mouth after you talk to him. I've been ill, her mother said, as if it wasn't obvious. That's enough to change anyone's tells.
Yes,
her daughter said, plowing ahead.
But the doctor you brought in, Dr. Michaels from Highgate Hospital, doesn't specialize in fibromyalgia. She specializes in poisons, her mother said.
At that, Alistair turned on his heel and retreated into the hall, snapping the door shut behind him. Poisons?
She also specializes in nanotechnology, Holmes was murmuring,
but it was clear her brain had run ahead of her emotions. Then,
oh, God, Mum, poison? But I hadn't noticed any signs. I should have. I never wanted.
Her mother's eyes burned.
You might have thought of that before you interfered with Lucien Moriarty.
Dizzily, I leaned against the wall. I still dreamt about it, what had happened to me that fall.
The poison spring, the fever, the hallucinations. It hadn't been a poisoning so much as a purposeful infection, but Bryony Downs had still made me into a pale, helpless wreck. I couldn't imagine what Emma Holmes was feeling.
"Where is Leander?"
Holmes asked, squaring her shoulders.
"Why on earth would he go without telling me goodbye?"
I braced myself for the reaction, but the fire had already gone out in her mother's eyes, and her face was gray again. You could see the veins in her forehead. I remembered the photograph I'd seen of her, all turned out in a black suit, her lips a dark, dark red, power crackling off her like a cut wire. I couldn't square it with the exhausted woman in front of me. Poisoned, I thought. My God. She must have taken a leave of absence from work. What had Holmes said she'd done again? Wasn't she a scientist?
"That isn't the issue at hand," Emma Holmes said.
She shut her eyes to concentrate on the words.
"You're telling me that Leander has snuck out like a fugitive, apparently days after you've been poisoned, and there's nothing to worry about?"
She turned to the study door.
"That this was all part of the plan? What on earth is happening?"
"We've tracked the poisoning back to the day you arrived. It was an isolated event, and we're taking precautions. We're controlling what we eat, what we breathe. We're culling the staff. We'll figure it out soon enough. But for now, Lottie, for your safety, there is no way you and Jamie can continue to stay here. I've transferred funds into your account for the trip. Go see your brother. Get out of this house."
With that, she lifted a hand as if to touch her daughter, but Holmes ignored it. Her back had gone straight and still. Her eyes narrowed.
"You need to believe it's for your own good," her mother said.
"For my own good," Holmes said.
"For your own good, maybe, but not mine. Never mine. You're a chemist. You'll have this under control by tomorrow. If I'm going, you're going. Then I'm going to find my uncle, because if I'm correct, he's in extreme danger."
Emma looked at me.
"You'll go with her?"
she said with despairing eyes. It wasn't a command so much as an entreaty, a peace offering to her daughter. Everyone in this house seemed to exist in opposition to themselves, anger and love and loyalty and fear all layered over each other into an incomprehensible blur. I opened my mouth to tell her no, that my mother would kill me, that I wasn't her daughter's valet or bodyguard, that out of everyone I knew, Charlotte Holmes could take care of herself, and if she couldn't, I was the last person she'd let help her. Blindly, Holmes reached out to clasp my hand in hers.
"I will,"
I heard myself say.
"Of course I will."
4. I decided that I had pretty good leverage to use to strike a deal with my father, because if I didn't, my mother would hunt me down and kill me for running off to Europe without parental supervision. "Leander left," I told my father, shifting the phone into my other hand. "Holmes's dad said he took off in the middle of the night. One of his contacts was getting antsy, I guess." As I spoke, I kept an eye on Holmes next to me in the back seat. She was wearing head-to-toe black, collared shirt, trim pants, a pair of black wingtip boots that I sort of wanted for myself. Between her knees, she balanced her small black suitcase with its giant silver clasps. Her straight hair was tucked behind her ears, and I watched her tapping furiously away at her phone, lips pursed. She looked dangerous, delicate. She looked like a whisper made real. She looked like she had a new case to solve. I didn't know how I felt about that. The phone line crackled.
"So, you're going to Berlin? To look for him?"
There was a plea in my father's voice. I couldn't think of the last time that so many adults had asked me favors all in a row, like I was someone to be bargained with and not just ordered around. It had been, to put it mildly, a strange week. A strange year. "I'm going to Berlin," I said, "because Emma Holmes has been poisoned by Lucien Moriarty, apparently." Holmes lifted an eyebrow at that, but said nothing. On her phone, I watched a text pop up from Milo.
"I ran that number. Leander was calling you from a burner. It makes sense, you know. He was undercover."
Find out where it came from. Where was it bought, and by whom?
I was having to stretch my neck fairly far at this point. With an exasperated sigh, she put the phone between us so I could read.
You're more interested in this than your parents' situation? Poisoning? Honestly, why on earth have they told you about this and not me?
Because I'm the smart, well-adjusted child, she wrote back. Less likely to seek revenge.
Are you now?
Tell me, have you already hauled Lucian out of Thailand and begun pulling out his teeth?
Not yet. For now, I'm assigning a security force to the Sussex House.
Yes, good, but within reason.
Naturally. You're not upset about Mother, are you?
Milo asked. Holmes hesitated before typing a response.
No, of course not. The situation is under control.
Apparently she's been poisoned, my father was saying. Jesus, Jamie, way to bury the lead. It's not that I haven't seen this sort of thing before with them. But listen, the Holmeses have always taken care of themselves. Still, while you're out there, do you mind casting out some feelers for Leander? Milo surely knows something. His spies have spies. I'd do it myself, but I have no idea how to contact him directly.
Of course, I said, and prepared to strike my deal.
I'll do that if you agree to tell Mom why I won't be in London for Christmas, and if you make sure she doesn't come out here looking for me.
He let out a long breath.
Is that what you'd like for your present? Me, roasting on a spit.
You could always fly to Germany and look for Leander yourself, I told him, which was unfair because I was sure that's exactly what he wanted to do. My half-brothers were both still tiny, though, and there was no way that my father would leave them over Christmas, not even to search for his missing best friend. I heard my father snort.
You are a piece of work, he said.
Yes, fine. I will tell your mother if you'll follow up with Milo. I'm sure he can spare a few bodies to look for his uncle.
I can tell you that Leander isn't in the city, the text on Holmes's screen read. At least not as himself.
He wouldn't be, Holmes wrote back. I need whatever contacts you have in Kreuzberg and Friedrichshain. Isn't there some mangy art school out there?
Hold on.
I have no idea what you're on about, I hissed at her. I thought we were going to Berlin. Where's Kreuzberg?
In Berlin, Holmes said, as though it were obvious.
Jeremy, my father asked. Can you send along those emails? I'm sure they'll be useful.
He hesitated.
I'd rather not, he said finally. But if you need any particular information, I can pass it along.
Why won't you just send them?
If Charlotte had written you every day for months, Jamie, can you honestly tell me you'd forward them all to your father without a second thought?
Of course I would. Of course I wouldn't. But there wasn't time to argue. The airport was looming in the distance.
Look, I have to go.
You need to promise me that you won't look for Leander yourself. He's created a complicated scenario, and I don't want you mucking it up. Promise me.
Not, it isn't safe. Not, I don't want you in danger. He just didn't want me blowing Leander's cover. It was nice to know that, as usual, he had his priorities straight.
I promise we won't go chasing after him, I said, not meaning a word.
How about that?
We're at the airport, miss,
the driver called, and beside me, Holmes burst out into horrified laughter at her phone.
I found you a guide, the screen read, but I'm afraid neither of you will approve.
No, because I was now remembering exactly who worked for Milo Holmes.
No, absolutely not.
Then I spat out a few other things that I'd heard on a dark Brixton street from the mouth of a man being curb-stomped.
Jamie,
my father asked,
what on earth is going on?
I hung up. I couldn't stop staring at Holmes's goddamn screen, which now read, tell Watson to watch his language, will you? He's blistering my poor wiretapper's ears. Despite being shuttled back and forth between England and America for most of my remembered life, or maybe because of it, I'd never traveled all that much otherwise. Our family vacations had always been underwhelming. Growing up in Connecticut meant that I'd made the one mandatory trip down to New York City with my family, but in our case we ate in chain restaurants and saw a Broadway show about rollerblading tigers. For that, as for most things, I blame my father.
After I moved to London, I went on vacation exactly once. My mother rented a camper van and took me and my sister to Abbey Wood. It was in the south of the city, barely a mile from our house. It rained all 4 days we were there. My sister and I had to share a fold-out bed, and I woke up on that last morning with her elbow physically inside of my mouth.